Okay, so February 13th, 2023. I don't know if you saw my email. I originally to you, Rabbi Kelman. I said originally it would be 3 to 4 classes, but judging from all the emails I'm getting and the things they want me to deal with, it'll be longer than that. But
I didn't see your email, but I didn't have to see your email to know that. We
okay.
have enough experience working together. I know it's never, and that's fine. That's fine. Listen.
And since there's so many people who I know haven't been on before with us and have emailed me, it's the first time they're listening. So I'll just repeat it as well. Check out our trips on the Torah in Motion website. The trips are all confirmed. The trip to Tunisia, the trip to Portugal, and the trip to Greece, all great trips if you'd like to join us. Okay, let me just begin with, I listened to the class as always, and I just have some comments. I showed you the dissertation, the front page of the title page of Solveig's dissertation, where it says he's from Prizren in Poland. And I was wondering, you know, why does it say that? And then it hit me as I'm listening to it. It's not just that that's where his mother's from. He's born there. Now, granted, he wasn't living there. He never lived there. So I'm still not sure why he wrote that, but he was born there. I also want to say I found it strange when I said about people might not understand when I said about Drachman. And I keep reading his autobiography. I'm trying to read a chapter a night that, you know, he kept a kosher home. What I meant by that, see, it means different things. Today, someone keeps a kosher home, that means they go to McDonald's and have a burger, but they won't bring it into the house. What I mean is that someone... I don't mean that he would eat, his family ate treif out. I just meant that, like in those, they're not a Shomer Shabbos family. So they're not being so machpid on kalim and the things that, that's what I meant. Now one of you asked me a question about this book, which we spoke about. We're going to speak about it again today. The Rav, Thinking Aloud, Transcripts of Personal Conversations with Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. And like I said, I'll get back to that today. I just want to say for now, as a preface, that you have to distinguish in this book between what the Rav says as part of an extended conversation, especially when he's responding to criticisms or questions of the students, and offhand comments. And there's no question that there are certain things in this book that were said specifically to David Holzer, his young shamash. He would speak very differently to his rabbinic colleagues. So for instance, just to give you one example, David Holzer asks him, he's going about girls singing together. You know, is that permitted? And the Rav tells him, look on page 118 and 119, the Rav says, actually, it's not on this page. It's somewhere around. Oh, yes. Page 120. Can you rely on any of the heterim regarding kolisha, such as multiple voices, or if they're saying divrei kedusha, you know, it's a sridi yesh. And the Rav replies, I know all the heterim and none may be relied upon. Okay. So here's the sort of thing that I said you have to understand who it's being said to and when, because and it's being said, I would say, regarding David's own circumstances, it says, where I hold David Holzer of going to Israel to, I think it even says it here, to start a school. I believe he says, yes, I asked the following question in the early 80s, shortly before starting my seminary in Israel. Now, so in reference to David Holzer going to Israel to start a school, and he asked him this question, the Rav gives this answer. But someone who reads this will assume that it's actually, you have to take it as it states, that the Rav knew of no heter to be relied upon. And yet the fact is that the Rav certainly knew of a heter because his own school, the Maimonides school, had girls' choirs or girls singing together in the choir and school performances with the boys, but as a joint choir. Now, today I'm told they don't do that anymore, but they absolutely did it in the time of the Rav and when I was living in Boston, etc. Furthermore, Rabbi Karmi, Shalom Karmi, testifies that the Rav told him specifically that he agrees with the Sridi Yesh's responsum on the topic. Not to mention the Rav and going to the opera, the whole story, the whole thing that we've gone into at other times. So there's an example where you have to see it. It's an answer for the time, not what we'd say a Madorah, it's a permanent answer. We'll come back to this in a second. I mentioned someone asked me at the end of class about the Rav and the Satmar Rebbe, and I said I knew of no contact. Thank you for Tzvi for saying that the Rebbe kept close ties on what was going on at YU because he was in touch with Rabbi Yosef Weiss. We're going to hear about Rabbi Yosef Weiss today. For those who don't know, Rabbi Yosef Weiss, who passed away not that long ago, was one of the longest-serving Rebbeim at YU, and apparently the Satmar Rav and would keep up on what's going on at YU from Rabbi Yosef Weiss. I want to show you guys a picture of the Rav. We spoke about the Rav and the letters. Let me show you a picture here of the Rav's handwriting, Hebrew letter. This is actually a letter I did not publish. I still have more to publish from the Rav. This is actually a letter from Yechielak of Weinberg, as you can see at top, from 1947. And it deals with, it's not actually, the handwriting here is not so difficult. Others are much more difficult, although the Aleph's are very strange. It deals with the plan to bring Rabbi Weinberg to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Yochanan. And which never happened. Rabbi Weinberg, it was tough for him to go to a place where he wasn't the head man. And going to Reb Yochanan, there were other Rosh Yeshiva, but the Rav was really regarded as the most important. Now, Rabbi Weinberg in a letter says that it's not my kavod, it's the kavod of the Talmidim. I was the head, and for me to go somewhere where I'm not the head, but of course, you know, people also are concerned about their kavod. And Rabbi Weinberg himself says, that if I'm given kavod, I'll take it, but I try not to chase after it, which I think is a very honest way of putting it. And a psychologist, I'm sure we have some with us, will tell us that, you know, people have to be careful about their kavod, and you can't let people walk over you. Now, in this letter, the Rav, in speaking to Rabbi Weinberg, he says to him, he says, tell me what, this is a fifth line from the bottom, speak openly to me. Hallo anashim achim anachnu. He says, we're brethren. And if he wants him to. Now this, some of you probably remember here, this expression comes right here with the story of Lot in, let's see, what perek is this? Chapter 13, perek A. Avram says to Lot, there shouldn't be a meriva, a conflict between us, ki anashim achim anachnu. Now, the Rav, not the Rav, Rabbi Weinberg felt so highly. I'll just tell you, I'll show you another letter because this is a letter I published on the Svarim blog, but I think you'll find it interesting. Oops, not that here. I found in YU that Rabbi Louis Bernstein, rabbi for decades, president of the RCA, I think twice, including during a controversial time when the he spoke before the conservatives, and he had the conservative head of the rabbinical assembly speak before the RCA. But he was a chaplain in Germany in the 50s, before he became rabbi in Queens. And for whatever reason, when he was there, he had a question, he decided to write to Rabbi Weinberg. And so here's the letter of Rabbi Weinberg, which I found in the archive. And in his letter to Rabbi Weinberg, Bernstein said that I've heard that you were there. Rav Soloveitchik is a student of yours. And he probably went on to say that, you know, I'm very close to Rav Soloveitchik. And look what Rabbi Weinberg writes. He says that Rabbi Bloch, not sure which Rabbi Bloch this is, was mistaken in thinking that Rav Soloveitchik is my student. Chalila lila hisabed. He goes, God forbid that I, you know, that, but by saying that, that he's my student, basically you're lessening his kavod. Why? He says he lived a number of years in Berlin and sometimes would come to my shiurim that I said at the Beis Medrash Rabbanim. He said, but he was not one of my, he did not need to hear lekach mipi. He didn't need to hear my Torah. But he came, why did he come? Because of friendship and the love that was between us. And also, l'chabdeini, Lifnei Talmidai, and also to show respect to me before my students. And he says, because of that, Rabbi Bloch has a, I think this is Rabbi Bloch. He's the Rabbi Bloch who was in, Stuttgart, I believe it was in Stuttgart. I published a letter from him in Chakira in which he speaks about, Agnon, a letter where a crazy story with Agnon. You can check it out. But he says, I understood, yadati, lohokir, et hakavod hagadol, shechilekli, by being present. I knew to appreciate the great kavod that the Rav gave me by being present at my shearing. Ki kvar az betziruto, even then in his youth, hayagon mufla, shehifli eskol gadoi ador. Even in those days when the Rav was a young man, he wasn't even 30 years old, he was known as a gon mufla, a great gon that, you know, he was amazed, all the great rabbis of the generation. So I think people will find that interesting. And finally, here. Remember I showed you this, and David Eisen said, was this an actual painting, or was this taken from a photograph? And I said, I have to get back to you, because I forgot the story. And I wrote the story here. This is a painting of the Rav. I'm the only one to ever publish it. As it says here, it was commissioned by his wife when he was 50 years old. The Rav later gave this painting to Rabbi Berman. It's currently hanging in his home. Now it appears on the book, the front page cover of the book. But this is a better picture than the one you're looking at now. I don't have it here, but you see it clearer here. And thank you, Tommy, for explaining exactly the story. The Rav was very appreciative of Julie Berman, for it was his lawyer, for doing certain legal work for him. And he later gave him this painting. Well, he wanted to pay him, Tommy says, and the Rav and Berman refused to accept money. But the Rav said, if professional service is rendered and you don't pay for it, it's not worth anything. It's a famous Gemara. So one day, so Julius Berman said, okay, I want to take a photographer and take a picture of this and make a painting for me. It turns out the Rav sent it to his house. Now, this is after the Rav's Rebbetzin had passed away, so maybe the Rav didn't feel it was so important anymore. And Tommy says that Julius Berman, he confirmed it with the daughters that it's okay, and they said this is what the Rav wants. So it's hanging in his home. So this is, I don't know of other Gedolei Yisrael who sat for a painting, although there was a painting of the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Yaakov Emden tells us, and we have Rav Yaakov Sasportas as a painting done of him. Now there's a painting, the famous painting of, it's a photograph of Rav Yehuda Assad. I can show you maybe next time, but that was actually taken after he was dead. His followers were in such distress, they wanted to have something to remember him by. He's dead. This is the Mari Assad, the great Gadol in Hungary. They sit him up in a chair and get his eyes open. I'll show you the picture next week. And they take a picture of him. And all the Rabbanim were so upset with this lady. They said, what a chil ames this was. But the Talmidim, they, you know, think of it today. Even if the sage is not with us, we have pictures. Now we have videos. But I mean, in those days, they want to have something to remember him by. So maybe I can show you, maybe I'll show you a picture of, one of the greatest of the Hungarian rabbis. And finally, I'll spend two more minutes on this because it's important and it's going to relate. It's not a side point. It relates to what we're doing. Eli, I said that the Rav didn't encourage people to go on Aliyah. And Eli points out, I think correctly, or sort of correctly, that he encouraged most of his Talmidim when asked, but it was those who he thought were going to be Torah teachers in America he didn't. Okay, so this is an important point about the Rav in Eretz Yisrael. And look, I wasn't a student of the Rav other than one summer, but I have interviewed many of the students and I've read his writings. And I think in this respect, this book is important because the Rav has a long conversation with the Talmidim in the Smicha Shir, and he expresses his opinion. And I think if I can summarize it, his opinion is that Yeshiva Aretz is a mitzvah. 100%. But it's not the be-all and end-all of Judaism. And he says some people can accomplish more in the diaspora. He says that people should not be made to feel that their Judaism is defective because they're living in Chutz Aretz. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael was one mitzvah among many. It's an important mitzvah, but it's not the basis of our Judaism. Now, this really is at odds with traditional religious Zionism, Rav Kook, of course, and going back to the Ramban, that by definition, a Jew living in Chutz Aretz, his Judaism is defective. The Ramban says the whole point of mitzvahs and Chutz Aretz is to prepare us for Eretz Yisrael. This is the basis of contemporary religious Zionism. By definition, if you live in Chutz Aretz, you can't be a complete Jew. And the Rav goes on that this is not true. He doesn't even know what to do with the Ramban. He can't accept the Ramban. He says, what about the Tosfos? What about the Rambam? Obviously, what about his grandfather? He can't accept that. And I think what I would say, a halachic man type of perspective. For one of the questions, he's challenged in the shiur by the students. Incidentally, even after going through everything I'm going to tell you, someone says to him, and after he's quoting Reb Chaim and everything, someone points out that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, the Orthodox youth are strong, they're self-confident, they're achieving a great deal. And then the Rav replies, I didn't say Reb Chaim is right. It's in me also. I mean, there are certain reservations, but I also have it. In other words, the Rav is admitting that he's torn. Intellectually, perhaps he sees Reb Chaim's position, but emotionally, he too is drawn to the state of Israel, to everything the reborn state of Israel means. In his talk before the Mizrahi, the Rav says, he speaks about the quasi-holiness of the flag of Israel. It's like the clothes of a martyr. One who's killed by non-Jews is buried in his clothes so that the spattered blood may be seen, and you know, because he was killed in this. So the clothes of a martyr have a certain sanctity, and the Rav says, how much more so the flag of the state of Israel, which represents, you know, all the people who were killed for it. It has a certain sanctity. We have to honor it. So Brisk is tugging at him. He doesn't really know what to make of it. But so listen to this, though. A student asks him, what if someone in America feels that he's in a stranger's country, but in Eretz Yisrael he feels at home? And what does the Rav say? So let him go to Eretz Yisrael. If he feels like that, I would anyway investigate him, examine him. In other words, the Rav feels that anyone who doesn't feel comfortable in America has some sort of psychological problem. From the Rav's perspective, you go to Eretz Yisrael to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, to do other mitzvah, to grow in your Judaism, to make a living. You don't go, he's saying here, because you don't feel comfortable in the diaspora. That's not how an Ish HaLacha evaluates matters. Why shouldn't you feel comfortable in America? You have everything you need. If you want to fulfill more mitzvot, that's a reason to go to Israel. And the Rav says, for people who will be able to fill, and I think for the Rav, that's the majority. If you can grow more in your Judaism, if you can fulfill more mitzvot, if you can do more, if you can be a better Jew, then you should go to Eretz Yisrael. But he says, for some people, Eretz Yisrael is not the place for them to be. They can do more. And he specifically says it's not just rabbis, it's others as well. And then after going through all this, and I'm summarizing it, he concludes, he says, these are just my thoughts. It's not halacha. If you feel I'm wrong completely, I won't feel insulted or offended. In other words, as all the students say, this is classic Rav. He doesn't tell you das Torahs, you have to follow what I'm saying. He's presenting his view. If they make sense to the students, then fine. And if not, that's also fine. And despite what he just says in this whole talk, he must have done something right, I think you can say, since more of the Rav's students, rabbis I'm talking about, went on Aliyah and became leaders of Torah education in the state of Israel than any other Rosh Hashiva in America by far. And yet we see that the Rav was not entirely on board. So that's what I'll say to you, Eli. We'll talk about it later more, because we'll get into more about Zionism. What I want to turn now, continue with our letters. In terms of the letters, he reminded me also that before the class, Rabbi Kelman mentioned this book, and that's why I didn't repeat it. He spoke, this is, if you want to get the collection of letters of the Rav, you get this book, Rabbi Helfgott's, who's spoken on Torah Motion a number of times, Community Covenant, The Commitment. This is the collection of the Rav's letters that we have. He did a very good job collecting them all. He found other letters subsequently that he published as well in an article. We have letters published, Hebrew letters by Dov Schwartz in Israel, Amichai Redziner. I have to say also that Rabbi Helfgott publishing the letters the second time around also was a spur for me to publish my letters, because I went to London and I sat in the Alexander Altman archives there. Alexander Altman was a scholar from Berlin. He was a an expert in Jewish philosophy. He was a rabbi in Berlin. Then he goes to Manchester for 20 years. He's communal rabbi there. Then he comes to Brandeis, and he remains as professor there. He was very close to the Rav in Boston. He also was a student of Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg. So I go to London, University College. They have his archive there, looking for letters. And I did find good stuff from Rabbi Weinberg. But I also found a couple of very interesting letters from Soloveitchik. And of course, I kept them in my files for all these years. Lo and behold, Rabbi Helfgott also got to them. I don't know if he went to London, but he wrote to the, or if he just wrote to them and got the letters. He knew that Professor Altman was also very close to the Rav. So he got the letters and published them. So that's, this is a very important book because, and I'm going to refer back to it because it's very relevant to some of the things we do. You have the Rabbi Soloveitchik's letter on Interfaith Chapel, on humane method of handling meat for slaughter, drafting rabbis and rabbinical students. That's where the Rav states his approach to halacha, that it's not an objective approach, that he says, I come with inclinations that are pushing me in a certain direction. That doesn't mean that every time you're going to get the answer, but he tells us he's not objective. He's being pushed in directions. And every posik he says is telling us, I think he's certainly speaking about himself, but I think he's speaking about all post-game. They have an inclination, a direction, an intuitive feeling. It's not an accident that every time you have a question regarding the state of Israel, the Satmar post-state comes out one way and the religious Zionist post-state will come out another way. He speaks here about Torah's Talmud study for girls, the Rav and Mizrahi prayer in a synagogue with mixed pews, all things we're going to get to. So let's pick up. Remember, I told you about this book by Beryl Wine, because El Al, we saw how annoyed the Rav was with El Al. And if you look in this book, this is a memoir. It's a short memoir of Rabbi Beryl Wine. It's only 150 pages or so. He tells us that he was the rabbinic administrator of OU Kashrus. And the OU, he tells us, supervised the commissary preparing the kosher meals for El Al. Sounds good. Problem was, the company was delivering food to the airline on Shabbos, so planes can make a quick departure on Saturday night. He says this was before El Al stopped flying on Shabbos, and its attitude towards traditional observance was tepid. The OU rabbi supervising the kashrus at the commissary, he says he's a well-known scholar, he doesn't tell us who, allowed this. But he said that he met with this rabbi when he found out about this, and the rabbi finally agreed not to allow deliveries until at least 45 minutes after sunset Saturday night. So El Al had to postpone its Saturday night flight by 2 hours. And then it says, all hell, he says, broke loose. I was accused of being anti-Zionist. Israel government ministers called me and protested vehemently, all because of a slight change in the flight schedule. It was the principle of the thing, he says, that no rabbis were going to tell us what to do. So he tells us that he discussed it with the Rav. And the Rav said that he had even received a call from the Minister of Transportation. And he said that the Rav told him, if you were Swiss Air, perhaps I could find a leniency. But for El Al, no such leniency. And that ended the matter permanently. Now, you can make the case that the food's the food. The fact that El Al was, look, I assume the people here listening to me, you stay at the Inbal, you stay at the King David, the Waldorf, where all the Haredim stay. These are all Mechalei Shabbos hotels, every single one of them. And yet we trust the kashrus because the idea is what's important is what goes on in the kitchen. And so I guess that was what the other rabbi was relying on. But as the Rav says, this is not Swiss Air. This is the Israel National Airlines. So you can't do that. And I'm assuming, I hope, now it's supposedly a Shomer Shabbos airline. If in the summer, let's say you're leaving in July and August. El Al leaves, I think, 8:55. So Shabbos over, let's say 9:15, New York area. If you don't mind, you can get there and you'll be there. So you won't be there. You'll be there an hour and 45 minutes ahead. That's as enough time as you need if they're pushing you through. You can't. United's tough because it's 10:55. So how are you going to get there? So I'm just hoping that El Al doesn't do anything in terms of the checks they need to do and all this stuff from the time Shabbos is over until the flight leaves. Now, that's only 2.5 hours, so it's not that much time. And if they are doing things, I'm hoping it's a non-Jew, but at least they're not supposed to be violating Shabbos that way. Following this, he tells us also, interestingly, that he got in trouble by people in the RCA. because the very next paragraph, the Rav certified Hashgacha. He gave Hashgacha in Boston, not just to me, to other things as well. And under the OU, some of the products of the Rav didn't meet the OU standards. And therefore, you had this strange situation where the OU gave Hashgacha to places and they wouldn't allow stuff that the Rav gave Hashgacha for. So Wang tells us that he was constantly criticized by people, you can imagine, they accused me of outright disrespect for Rabbi Soloveitchik and not accepting all products bearing his name. And this wasn't Rabbi Wine's policy, it was Rabbi Rosenberg's policy at the OU. And he says, though, the Rav never raised it with them. But once the Rav said to him that as the rabbi in Boston, it's my duty to grant kosher certification to products that are kosher, even if they don't necessarily reach the highest standards of kosher. I know you have to operate under a different set of rules. Don't be troubled that the OU doesn't use products I certify. I'm not troubled by it. So, in other words, the Rav was saying that I'm the rabbi of a kehila here, which has all different levels of religiosity. So I have to have a big tent. So I'm giving hashgacha to things, and not everyone needs to rely on this. But I do find it a little strange, because isn't that what we think the OU is? The OU isn't a hamish hashgacha. Isn't the OU also supposed to be about the big tent? It's not just for Borough Park and Muncie, but the people who live out in Kansas City and Montana and everything. So you can go into any supermarket in the country and find kosher items. Since when is the OU supposed to be regarded as something that's not meant to serve the people? Or maybe there has to be an OU regular, an OU Mahadran, I don't know. I just find it interesting because remember, there were, at that time, the OU, it's not like today was a million hashkachas. The OU was like the mainstream hashkacha of the mainstream modern Orthodox organization. So why should the Rav feel that the OU should be at a higher level than his hashkacha? I mean, what does that mean? The Rav wasn't saying he's maybe relying on certain kuas, but it's kosher. It's just the typical person buying from the OU, it's not at that level. So it's sort of like the Rabbanut. At least I thought, but the OU doesn't act like the Rabbanut. The OU, the OU is the one telling you not to eat stuff from the Rabbanut. So it's interesting. Maybe in my book, the Halach History of America, well, not maybe, definitely, I have a whole discussion of kashrus in America and all these things. So now I want to return to the next letter of ours. This is letter number 4. Also, big letter. Some of you might even remember this because there's a famous event and where the Rav helped out people to the right, I guess you could put it. Well, what do I mean by this? Well, letter 4, Chinuch Atzmai is the Aguda school system in the right-wing Agudas Yisrael based school system in the state of Israel. Now they don't call it only Agudas Yisrael because they've had splits, but the Haredi school system. So you have the secular government school system, you have the Dati school system, and you have the Agudas Yisrael that had their own school system. And they had to raise a lot of money for it because the amount of money they got, it wasn't like an official government. They got some money, but they had to raise a lot of their own money for it. I don't know today how much they get, if they're completely funded or not. But in those days, they weren't. And the letter, it's a letter from 1962, and we have examples, not just from this letter, there's at least one other letter, if not two, where the Rav sends out a letter on his letterhead endorsing Chinuch Atzmai. Here he says, I endorse the sacred work. I have heartily endorsed the sacred work done by the Chinuch Atzmai. He says that this movement has spread the influence of Torah to 90 communities, religious education to 40,000 children. And he says that there's going to be a dinner at the Hotel Pierre. This is 1962. I appeal to my friends in the rabbinate to do their utmost to make this event, make this undertaking a financial success. And the Rav, I'm certain every year, not just sent out the letter, but even wrote a check for it. The Rav, there are a few canceled checks that have appeared online from the Rav. I think one is Chinuch Atzmai. One, if I'm not mistaken, is for Lakewood. We know that the Rav even gave to the Eda Charedis. Now, why would the Rav give the Eda Charedis? Abel Vovitz told the story that he once came to the Rav, and walking out of the Rav was one of these Eda Charedis guys. And he showed him, because apparently Abel Vovitz had told him, I will never give you money. And he showed him a picture of the check the Rav gave. So Mr. Lovitz went into the Rav and was screaming, Rebbe, how could you have given them money? You know that if you came to Israel, they'd be at the airport, they'd be attacking you, they'd be holding signs saying, go back to America. And the Rav, with a smile, said, yes, that's true, but he promised me that the money I give him won't be used for the signs. I guess the Rav had a soft spot for, you know, his uncle was part of that group. So, but it's not just that the Rav sent out these letters and encouraged people to give. At a famous event in 1956, the Rav himself appeared and gave one of his most famous drushas. In 1956, Rav Aaron Cutler asked Rav Soloveitchik to be the honorary chairman of the Chinuch Atzmai dinner. And the Rav, I'm going to play part of the drusha that he gave for you. The Rav used his influence to get people to give money, and he appeared there. In the book, here, Drushos and Ksavim of the Rav's Drushos, you have the drusha that the Rav wrote out that he's supposed to give. And it talks about Rav Aaron Cutler and all that, but that's not the drusha he gave. When he actually, I don't know if he changed his mind or he ad-libbed, whatever he did, he does speak about Rav Aaron Cutler, but he says things differently and he begins differently. He talks about how Stephen Klein had to send, you know, Shotrin, two guards to make sure he'd come. He jokes, and it's fascinating the differences here. I mean, extremely different. The whole version is different. If you want to see the actual text of it, you have to look here. Almost Bunim, a fire in his soul. Because page 365, you have a transcript taken from the tape of Rav Soloveitchik's entire address there. And let me show you a couple things here. Well, first, there's a whole YouTube video, The Untold Story, an unprecedented gathering in support of Torah, in which they interview various people who were involved, and they tell the story.
Have you ever wondered why teeth can last thousands of years in fossils but get ruined by a simple piece of chocolate?
Dinners during that period. Rav Yosher Baer by then had moved away from Agudat.
And so interviews with various people involved, but I'm more interested, we have the Rav's voice. And it's amazing. It's an amazing drasha, in particular when he speaks about Rav Aaron Cutler. Because look, his philosophy was not Rav Aaron Cutler's philosophy, but the appreciation he had for Rav Aaron. Here you can just, for those who've never heard the Rav's voice, and he was regarded as the greatest darshan of his day in Yiddish. I don't know if they say that about English as the greatest. There's lots of darshaning. You have Rabbi Lookstein, and who was a great preacher, and Herbert Goldstein. But in Yiddish, the Rav, bar none. He would speak on Yortzeit Drasha 4 hours, 2 hours halacha, 2 hours agada. And so here's the Rav's voice, and you can see the English here too. When he starts praising Rav Aaron and comparing him to his grandfather, Rav Aaron's like pulling on his jacket not to do that. I mean, the Rav, it's some drasha. My Yiddish is I get like 70% without the words on the bottom, but with the words on the bottom, it's like I said, 100%. But it's even if you don't know any Yiddish, it's worth listening to, because it's there he was talking softly. Other times he's talking loudly, and it's completely different than what he prepared to say when he got there. So I don't know if this was written out or he just was talking and talking. In fact, someone there, and David Eisen, our listener, I think it's on that video, mentions this in the comments there, as if it's a guy keeps snapping pictures of him, and the Rav stops the Yiddish and says in English, enough with the pictures already. So it's interesting. And I think it's important because we see there that Rav Soloveitchik had a large view of the Jewish world. He was able to appreciate all the positive that was being done on the more right wing. He wasn't abandoning his approach, but was doing what he could to help out. And that's what makes the picture with which I include in my book, Changing the Immutable, so disturbing. The famous picture from that event, which I don't have with me now, but many of you have seen it from my book. There's a picture of Irving Bunim together with Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Soloveitchik when they did the biography. I've shown this picture many times before. When they did the biography of Rav Aaron Cutler, some person did a biography, they cut out Rav Soloveitchik. And so he's not in the picture. And it's such a disgrace because Rav Aaron Cutler, with all the disputes over the proper way to raise the next generation, he obviously respected, not only did he respect Rav Soloveitchik, he wanted him to be a partner with him on Chinuch Atzmai. So a very interesting, worthwhile letter. Now, the next letter is really fascinating, and it's going to get us into an interesting topic. The letter is sent to Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg. Irving Yitz Greenberg, great influential person. It's hard to think of people who've accomplished as much in his lifetime. If he would have stopped working in the 1970s, you'd say what he accomplished a lot. From being rabbi, from my alma mater, he's the one who made sure it was kosher at Brandeis. He was Rabbi Young Israel Brookline and in Riverdale rabbi, professor at YU, City College, American Holocaust Museum, important author, theologian, really getting on the edges of orthodoxy, radical thinking, problematic in many ways. But this letter takes us back, also his debates, his arguments with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, which recently, I think it was at Aleph, revisited them, because Yitz Greenberg gave an interview to the commentator where he expressed interesting views, let's put it that way. But he got involved in two areas that were controversial in the Orthodox world, interfaith and also interdenominational. Now, we have a letter here. It's an interesting letter, and from 1966, or 65, actually, because of Tishrei, Tashin Chav Vav, and the Rav is speaking to him about a matter. I'll read it part of you. And when I asked Yitz Greenberg, however, he didn't remember whether the Rav was talking to him about interfaith or interdenominational, although he thinks it's interfaith, and I think it's interfaith also. And I'm going to speak about the Rav and interfaith in a second. But this is what the Rav. So Greenberg went to the Rav. He was going to go. I don't think there's any question that he was. The context is he was going to some interfaith ecumenical gathering, and we know the Rav's position on this. And people obviously were telling Greenberg that how could you do this? Now Greenberg is not a Talmud of the Rav. He's from the Vardic, actually, but he's a quasi-Talmud. That is, he looks to the Rav as one of his Rebbes, even though he never studied under him. And the Rav says as follows, and Greenberg apologized, you can see from the Rav's letter, for going to the interfaith. It's definitely interfaith. It's not interdenominational, because the Rav was not really opposed to interdenominational dialogue of the sort we're speaking about here. So he wrote to the Rav apologizing for this, and the Rav apologized for partaking in this group, conference, whatever it was. There is absolutely no need for apologies or explanations. You are certainly entitled to your opinion as much as I am mine. So here we see again the Rav not insisting on Das Torah. I have never demanded conformity or compliance, even from my children. I believe in freedom of opinion and freedom of action. Obviously, freedom of opinion, freedom of action in the large Orthodox tent. But the Rav, as we saw with what we mentioned about the Eretz Yisrael, he set forth his position, he defends his position, and he's inviting you in, say, do you accept what I say? Do you share my opinion? And if you do, Very good. If you don't, that's your opinion. There's freedom of speech. When you consulted me about your participation, all I said was in the form of a hesitant advice, which I addressed not to you, but to myself. In fact, I spoke in the first person, the Rav says. Namely, if I were invited, I would not accept. I did not instruct, nor did I try to convince you. Since you have made up your mind in accordance with your own view, all I can say to you is go and be successful, and may God be with you. So the Rav, so Greenberg goes to the Rav. He speaks to him, should he attend this conference, this gathering, whatever it was. The Rav says, I wouldn't do it. It's not, then maybe the Rav gave him reasons why. Greenberg goes anyway, and then people said that he insulted the Rav because he asked the Rav his opinion, and he didn't listen to the Rav. If you ask a psak and you don't listen, then that's a terrible way. You go to a Rav, you ask a psak, and then he gives it to you, and then you ignore him. So he writes to the Rav apologizing, and the Rav says, I wasn't hustling for you. I was offering my opinion. I was saying that I don't think it's the best thing to do. You had a different opinion. It's not my opinion. I don't think it's the best thing. But since you are convinced that is, all I can say to you is be successful. So the Rav's response to Greenberg is very different than all the others, the Rav's Talmidim, who were attacking Greenberg so harshly. I think it's an amazing letter, not just because it shows a level of respect for Greenberg, even while disagreeing, at the same time that people were, you know, already trying to read him out of orthodoxy. But the idea that the Rav's position is that I'm not giving das over here. I'm not forcing people to accept my opinion. We're not dealing with halachic matters per se, where I can say this is the halacha. Anything that's not halachic is out. The Rav could be very firm when it comes to halacha. But on these ideological matters where there's, it's not about halacha as much. What's the best thing to do? What's the proper approach? The Rav is saying, I think this is the proper approach. You disagree. I think you're wrong, but you're entitled to be wrong. You're entitled to have your opinion. And since you don't accept what I said, I hope it works out well. So I think it's a very, very nice, letter. It was actually discovered by Josh Fagelson, who got a PhD at Northwestern. He's a rabbi out in the Chicago area. He didn't, that's how I became aware of it, but he didn't publish the whole letter. And then he couldn't find the whole letter. He didn't have the whole letter. It was lost in his files. So I got a copy of the original letter from, and here it appears in complete for the first time. I got it from Harvard. And they said, though, that I can't publish it unless I get Yitz Greenberg's permission. So I got his permission, and so it appears. Now, this matter of the Rav and interfaith dialogue, it's a complicated issue, and there's been different approaches to it. You can go online. You can see a debate between Eugene Korn and David Berger. There's even... Got it this week, Shavat, this 5783, the HaMizrahi, which I mentioned how I think it's become a very good magazine here. And I don't read it in show. I take it home and I read it at home, although lots of people, you see them reading it in show. But this very issue is interesting because it's about Israel as a light unto the nations. And on page 14, you have an interview with Yitzhak Adlerstein, Interfaith or Multifaith, a conversation with Yitzhak Adlerstein, who's director of interfaith affairs for the Wiesenthal Center. And he's very much involved. I like him, and everything he writes, I find worth reading. But I have to say that we have to make some corrections here to what he says, because in speaking about interfaith dialogue, and he's involved in interfaith dialogue, and he speaks eloquently about how the evangelicals are important, very important, because they are, in the Christian world, they are the real supporters of the state of Israel. And he explains why he thinks it's that he never would have dreamed when he was in yeshiva, and he doesn't come from YU, Neri Searle, I believe, that he'd be spending much of his time speaking to Christians and other religious groups, mostly Christian, and why he thinks from a religious standpoint, this is valuable and important. It's very nice. But then he says as follows, dealing with the Rav. That's why I bring it up. Rav Soloveitchik's position on this is very important. The Rav was 100% against interfaith dialogue. He wrote about it. It's a matter of record. Okay, if Adlerstein just said the Rav was against interfaith dialogue, I wouldn't be commenting. But he says 100% against it. So I have to say that he is incorrect on this. He says, by the way, he goes on, his opposition to it was surpassed only by his cousin, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Well, if the Rav's 100% opposed to it, how could it be surpassed by anyone? If it's 100%, that's 100%. And then he says, the Rav always had one person whom he trusted to do interfaith dialogue. For many years, it was Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, and when he passed away, the baton was passed to Rabbi Dr. David Berger. Okay, so if the Rav did permit interfaith dialogue with Wurzberger, then how could you say he's 100% opposed to it? And then he explains that the Rav felt that someone had to speak to the broader world on behalf of the Torah community, because we don't want reform and conservative rabbis to speak, be the only one speaking, because then they're going to give a presentation of what Torah is, and it won't be accurate. Okay, so again, the first sentence that he's 100% against interfaith dialogue is contradicted by the rest of that paragraph and by the next paragraph. But it's more than that, because the Rav was not against interfaith dialogue 100%. What the Rav was against was interfaith dialogue on theological, religious matters. He was not against interfaith dialogue regarding matters of general human concern. Let me read you. He says as follows, to give, and this is in the Helfgott book, in one of his articles, one of his letters dealing with this. The Rav says on page 260, it's improper to enter into dialogues on Judaic monotheism and the Christian way of Trinity, messianic idea in Judaism and Christianity, Jewish attitudes towards Jesus, the concept of covenant, Judaism and Christianity, Eucharist, the church and the synagogue, et cetera, et cetera. The Rav is against theological dialogue. And the Rav explains, there's two reasons. He explains how theology, we have our theology, they have their theology. It's intimate to us, and other people can't understand it. It doesn't make sense. We can't really share that. That's like an intimate thing. And second of all, he speaks about, and he's very worried about this idea of quid pro quo. You know, they're going to make changes, and they're going to demand we make changes in our approach. You know, after Vatican II, when they updated their doctrine about the Jews, now they're going to want us to update things. But the Rav says explicitly, quote, when we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication among the various faith communities is desirable and even essential. We are ready to enter into dialogue on such topics as war and peace, poverty, freedom, man's moral values, civil rights, et cetera, et cetera. So the Rav says interfaith dialogue on matters of human concern, universal religious problems. Yes. We are ready to discuss universal religious problems. We will resist any attempt to debate our private individual commitment. So no discussions of theology. However, yes, discussions how we can stop poverty. How, I mean, if the Rav was alive today, couldn't imagine today the progressive assault on religious values coming from, not just Hollywood, but the whole progressive circles is such that religious groups, Jews, Christians, Muslims, might feel it valuable to come together to formulate responses. The Rav supported this 100%. Point number one. Point number two, what does interfaith dialogue mean? The Rav says in this letter, which I'm reading, and there's other letters, but this letter was an open letter published to the RCA in November 64. The Rav says, we are opposed to any public debate, dialogue, or symposium concerning the doctrinal, dogmatic, or ritual aspects of our faith regarding other faiths. Notice what he says, public debate. Dialogue or symposium, public. I work in a Catholic university. The Rav's not talking about if I want to discuss with one of my neighbors down the hall, what the Christian view is about this and why Jews disagree. If one of my, and it happens all the time, a colleague will come in and say, how have Jews dealt with this issue? That's not what the Rav is referring to. That's never was what the Rav was referring to. Would it surprise you if I told you that the Rav's, his most famous English essay, an essay which is now studied in Catholic seminaries and other places, The Lonely Man of Faith, was first delivered at a Catholic seminary in Boston, St. John's Seminary. The Rav was invited to deliver a lecture to a Catholic seminary. Seminary is still there. And he delivered, that's where The Lonely Man of Faith was first delivered. The Rav had no problem because there he wasn't in a dialogue. He was expressing a view of faith that Christians can also benefit from it. And the Rav had no issue privately. The Rav read Catholic theological works. He read other Protestant theological works. He would have no problem on an individual level discussing this. But in a public setting, when it's not intellectual, when it's about, when there's a tachlis here, that's the whole point. All these interfaith gatherings are not about just intellectual, you know, well, how would a Jew respond to Augustine's point here? That's not what it's about. It's about trying to change policies. It's about trying to adopt new approaches to the other, that sort of thing. And that's going to lead to Jews being pressured to compromise on sacred ideas. So that in those two areas, I have to clarify what Rabbi Adlerstein says about the Rav being 100%. He was 100% opposed to theological dialogue, absolutely. As long as I'm talking about it, Rabbi Adlerstein, you'll forgive me. You know how much I respect you. But there's another mistake he makes. In talking about it, he says that he quotes the Rambam's view of that the Rambam held you could actually teach. The halacha is you can't teach non-Jews Torah. It's not in the Mishnah Torah, by the way, but that's the Gemara says it. The Rambam was asked in a responsum, and he says it is the halacha. Why he didn't include it in the Mishnah Torah is a question. But he says it doesn't apply to Christians, because Christians share our sacred text, the Old Testament, and Tanakh, and therefore they could study it with us, and they could learn their errors and be corrected, and he thinks that's okay. But now Rabbi Adlerstein says as follows. Now, the Rambam hated Christianity, though I don't know if he ever met a Christian in his life. He lived in Muslim countries. His tormentors were all Muslim, but he did not like Christianity. And he goes on to explain why he still gave this ruling that you can teach Christians Torah. What I want to point out, when he says they never met a Christian, he doesn't know he met a Christian, and he lived in Muslim countries, it's not true. The Rambam comes in 1165 to the land of Israel. The land of Israel was a crusader kingdom then. He lands in Akko. This was a crusader kingdom. Jerusalem was crusader kingdom. The crusader kingdom goes from 1099 to 1187. So the Rambam knew Christians very well. He lived under the Christians when he was in the land of Israel. It's not just some foreign thing he's speaking about. If you look in Joel Kramer, the late Joel Kramer's book on the on Maimonides, here it is, page 137, he talks about how, you know, the Rambam goes to Jerusalem and there was a crusader ban on Jewish residents in Jerusalem. So he can only visit the city for business and prayer. But under the crusaders, Jewish pilgrimage to Jerusalem increased. Akko, he says on page 133, Akko was in Maimonides' time a city with a very heterogeneous population, including European Christians, local Christians, and Jews. That is, you had Italians, French, Byzantine. On page 135, in the decade after the Crusader conquest, Jews tried to return to the cities of the Holy Land, except Jerusalem, where they're barred from residing. So you can read all about it there. Actually, I found a good map online here. Might be interested. There's a... Here, this is an article by Walter Wurzberger where he mentions the Rav's classic article. This is from Tradition 94. The Holy Man of Faith was first presented at oral lecture at a Catholic seminary in Brighton, and he says that Professor Torsky told him that the Rav once considered an invitation to deliver a lecture at the Christian Jewish Colloquium held at the Harvard Divinity School. What Wurzberger says is, yeah, what I said. While I looked upon interreligious discussions of purely theological issues as exercise of futility, he approved of discussions devoted to sociopolitical issues. Okay, contrary to widespread misconceptions, his essay Confrontation and the Guidelines for Interfaith Discussions were not intended to forestall meaningful exchanges between representatives of Judaism and of other religions. Okay, so here I found a website which shows, so here's what the Crusader Kingdom looked like. You see the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and then you go down, it shows you the map, the Rambam's journey to Eretz Yisrael, where he makes his way there, and then from Akko to Jerusalem. Oh, and here, what does it have here? He goes from Spain to the Maghreb. This is an old map, so everything's not exactly what we would see it today. But you know, when he comes to Jerusalem, here you have it here, the he goes on the Temple Mount. It says that this is the letter that's not just recorded by Rav Ezra Zikri, but it's, we have it in manuscript. Then the 10th of the month of Iyar, that's when he landed in Akko, and then in, later on in Sivan, he leaves the ship in Akko, and then he comes to Jerusalem in Mar Cheshvan. It says on Sunday, where does it say? No, it says on Tuesday. The fourth day of the month of Cheshvan, in the year 4926 in time of creation, I left Akko and set out for Jerusalem. And then it says, this is his letter to, is this the one where it says he went, this is not the one where he says, he has another letter where he says, I entered the great holy and holy house and prayed there on Thursday, the sixth of the month of Cheshvan. Actually, they don't have the proper translation here. They don't have that. Here it is. Sorry. I entered the great holy house on the 6th of Mar Cheshvan. Correct. I'm sorry. So what does that mean? He entered the holy house. That seems to be he was on the Temple Mount. What else could it be? Now, we have here Rabbi Shalat in discussing this. He has both letters. First, there's also a letter to Yafet HaDayan. This is in volume 1, page 230. You see that he says that I think it's here. He says also, yes. No, I don't. I can't find it now here. But he speaks about how. He says we. That is my father, my brother. Halachnu beveit Hashem beregesh. He says we were in the house of God. And the earlier letter, I'll read it for you. We have it in the Hebrew. He says that. He says that it's a day festival when he arrived in Eretz Yisrael, and he says on Yom Shlishi b'Shabbat Arba Miyamim Le'erech Mar Cheshvan Yatzana Me'Akko El Yerushalayim V'Nichnasti L'Bayit Hagadol V'Kadosh V'Palti Bo, and he prayed there. And the reason I was confused now, because I seem to recall people saying that he made it a day of memorial, of celebration, the day that he went on the Temple Mount. But that's not what he says. He says the day that he arrived in Israel, Yom Zenad Darki Shiyam Sasam Basimcha. That is the day that Yatzati Min Hayam, the day that he left the ship and came to Akko. So we see that the Rambam, it's not just that he's referring to Christianity as Avodah Zarah, which he does, because he didn't know Christians, and that's, people often say that he knew Christians. He was in the Crusader Kingdom, and then he leaves, and he goes to, we don't know how long he was there, but he was there months, if not years, at least a couple of years, perhaps, but because by 1167, I think he's in Egypt, but he's definitely was there, and he lived under the rule of the Christians. So when he gives a judgment of what Christianity is, the Rambam doesn't give judgments without investigation, knowing what he's talking about. So he definitely knew Christians. Okay. So let me begin with Nissan saying to me, respectfully, it's the Jewish Testament, not the Old Testament. So I'll say something that some of you have heard me say, because Nissan, you're not the first person to say, when I give a talk sometimes and I say the Old Testament, sometimes people come up respectfully and say, not to say the Old Testament. And the truth is that in the academic world, they don't call it the Old Testament, the New Testament. They call it the New Testament. They don't call it the Old Testament. They call it the Hebrew Bible. But I've said it once, Nissen, and I'll say it again. We'll see if you accept what I say, that we are traditional Jews. We like the old. It's the new we're not so crazy about. Chadash Asr Min HaTorah. We have no problem with the old. We like the old. So yes, I say that our Torah, the Tanakh, that's the Old Testament, the authentic one. That's what we like. It's the new we're not so crazy about. So I have no problem with the Old Testament, because to me, saying something is old doesn't imply, well, it's old, but now we have new is better. Professor Twersky once said to me that he said, most people like old buildings and young people. He said, I like new buildings and old people. But the point is that when I say old, I don't think it implies old out, you know, bring in the new. That's the Western mentality. But we know
it's the supersessionist mentality. That's my concern.
We do. The older, the better. The closer to Sinai is the better. So that's why. But I understand your opinions. It seems to be what everyone thinks, but I'm trying to change that. And let us bring back, like the Chasam Sofer said, the new is what we don't like. Okay, so someone asked me to say something about the Rav's relationship to Israel and that Rebbetzin Pesha, who we'll speak about. In fact, the letter that wasn't published, Rebbetzin Pesha is going to figure. She had a great love for Eretz Yisrael, taught this love, etc. When the Rav had a great love for Israel also, but every Jew had a great love for Israel. Every Jew in Europe had a great love for Israel. We pray for it all the time. That's different than saying, though, that if you don't live in Israel, you're half a Jew or you're not a complete Jew, and that every Jew has to move to Israel and every Jew has to. The Rav explains that, of course the Rav was a Zionist, the big Zionist, the super Zionist. I mean, he's the leader of the Mizrahi, but the idea that this means that you cannot lead a complete Jewish life in Chutzlarts. Some people, they're supposed to be in Chutzlarts. They have a job. The Rav says, he says that you could, he doesn't say not just a rabbi, he says you could have a job and you could be making Kiddush Hashem what you're doing. You could be accomplishing important things there. And you support the state of Israel, he says, by sending money and everything. So the Rav didn't see it the way Rav Kook saw it, in the way that often we grow up thinking that by definition we have to live in Israel. And the Rav, he didn't have that. He didn't have that. What can I say? And you... that's all I want to say. I'm not Rabbi Meiselman. I'm not saying he's not a Zionist. Of course he's a Zionist and he's a big believer in it, but not in the messianic sense and not in the idea that, and this is what, if you got a religious Zionist education, this is what you're often taught, that you can't be a complete Jew without living in Eretz Yisrael. And that's what the Rav is rejecting in this discussion back and forth, with the students, that you can be a Zionist and you can appreciate Eretz Yisrael, and you can recognize that most people, their place should be in Eretz Yisrael, but there still is a place for Chutzlarts. He says the Rambam at the end of the day was a diaspora Jew, and he says we can't take away from him this idea that we can't judge him this way. I think that's what's driving the Rav. David says, well, the Rav possibly specifically a school in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to the U.S.? Yes. It's, he says this seminary, David Holzer gives the name of the seminary that he was going to be establishing there. I'll read you the name of it again. I read it once, I'll read it again. He says that shortly before starting my seminary in Israel called Machon Bina, this was in the early 1980s. Now, I was in Israel 84 to 85. I don't remember seminary Machon Bina. Maybe people remember. But 100% the Rav knew of such a heter, but in speaking to David Holzer, this is how I understand it. He says to him that I don't, you know, David asks him, so he says, I don't know a heter. But like I said, the Rav knew a heter because his own school had a heter, and the Rav expressed his support for Rav Yaakov Weinberg's position. And NCSY, which followed Rav Soloveitchik in their psukim, they followed this as well. So, University of the Study of Rabbinical Seminary in America. That's Chafetz Chaim, right? David says, who said that the deliveries on behalf of El Al were being made by Jews? Well, he doesn't say that, but the assumption is that the Jews are working there. It doesn't just have to mean, David, the deliveries per se, but organizing it, getting it ready. In other words, for the deliveries to be made, even if it was a non-Jew who delivered it, some El Al worker is working on Shabbos at the place, at the freezer where they're having all these things and is arranging it. So the point is that the whole structure, everything that's going on, needs El Al employees, and El Al employees are generally Jewish. Not to mention the fact that as far as the Rav is concerned, this itself is a Chil Hashem, that El Al even if non-Jews are involved, is doing things like this on Shabbos, he didn't think it was appropriate. Elaine says, I believe the Rav certified Kraft cheese in the 50s. No, no, no. The Rav never certified the Kraft cheese. Kraft cheese never had a hashgach. What the Rav said was that Kraft cheese is kosher. Not everything in America where we've been accustomed to believe that if it doesn't have hashgacha, it can't be kosher. I hope this is not radical. This is like basic kashrus 101. Hashgacha just tells you if it's kosher. It's not like shlita. It doesn't make it kosher. So if you know factually that something's kosher without a hashgacha, it's just as kosher with or without the hashgacha. Sometimes this will come up when a product, a certain product will go under hashgacha, and they'll send out an announcement that even though they haven't changed the packaging, you can still eat it because we tell you it's all kosher. No, the Rav, this is an issue as to how you understand cheese. We know that there are certain things that the sages forbid us to eat, such as wine, non-Jewish wine, or non-Jewish milk. So the question is, what's the reason for it? Is the reason just a gzera, a takana, like wine? Or is it simply a factual thing that, like milk, that they said you couldn't drink the non-Jewish milk because we're afraid they might use pig's milk or something. But if you have another way of determining that it's kosher milk, or if you know that there's no pigs in the area and the only milk used is cow's milk, then you can eat it, drink it. The cheese, it's a machokas. It's gavina sakum. Is cheese like the wine example, that it's a takana and that a Jew has to be involved, like shlita, a Jew has to shakta, a Jew has to be involved in the process, or is cheese, and this is there's an opinion that tells us this way, or is cheese like the milk example, that it's just to ensure about the rennet? The Rav in the 50s, I don't know when he stopped, if he ever stopped holding it, he held that like this position. And therefore, since at that time, I don't know if Kraft cheese is like this today at all, but at that time it was all vegetable rennet. Therefore, Kraft cheese was kosher. And he told this to his Talmidim and other people, and it became well known. Although Rav Schechter in one of his books says that he told the smicha students in the shiur not to tell the Baal Batim, because the Baal Batim won't know the difference and they'll make mistakes on this. If you go to your supermarket today, you'll see something called a tablet K. All these like fancy cheeses will have a tablet K. In fact, one of you listening to me emailed me, can I eat tablet K? I'm not a poseg. I'm not the Rav. You have to ask your local rabbi. But I'm telling you, no one in America eats the tablet K. And I spoke to the rabbi once. This is Rabbi Safra. He's a student of the Rav. Sephardic Musmach, he passed away recently. One of the only Sephardic Musmachim of the Rav. The first was Rabbi Maimon of Seattle, by the way. And he held, like the Rav, that early opinion. But I can tell you that no one eats it. And although people buy it because they don't know, if you see the tablet K in the supermarket, it's definitely Gavina Sakum, as is currently the accepted opinion of everyone there. Ruth says the OU didn't accept the Rav. Hashkacha, politics got into the supervision. Shocking. Well, I wouldn't say it's politics. Politics is when one rabbi... And there's no basis. Like if one rabbi says you can't trust another rabbi's hashgacha, which happens a lot, politics is always involved. But this is a different issue. In other words, the Rav, it wasn't a monetary matter. It wasn't a fight in that respect. It was just that they felt that maybe the Rav was being more liberal on certain things that they would. Remember, the OU was trying to achieve acceptance. They started out as a modern Orthodox hashgacha. And they want to achieve acceptance in the right-wing world. And therefore, if you want to be accepted in the right-wing world, you have to, your bottom line has to be perhaps higher than most of the average person would follow, because you have to make sure that pretty much everyone, I don't know about the Hasidim, but at least in the literature world, follows it. So you know the OU, for all these years, I don't know what they're going to do now, but they always would have two posts. You would have Rebelsky for the Yeshivish and Rav Schechter. So you always, and the OU with the Mashkichim, they come from all the yeshivas, from YU to the most right-wing yeshivas. So the OU has been very successful and what that meant is that the OU had to abandon certain practices. For example, God kosher. Why should the OU only have, in Lita they never had God kosher, the Rav never had God kosher, or Moshe, I mean, this was not the practice. So why, and why don't they just have, and then they could have maybe Glot and regular kosher. But no, they don't. they've adopted a policy that since when the American Orthodox community started going to the right, so they didn't want to be left out. And I mean, that explains you can see two books that came out about kashrus in America in the last few years discusses this. David says, today there exists a more modern tract that is Mamachti Haredi that includes a core curriculum and includes math and English and matriculation exams. And this is very divisive. Yeah, my question, here, Nissan says, thank you. Memshala funding for Aguda schools only became policy starting, after Begin comes into power. Very nice. Okay. And someone privately says that kashrus in Boston was very complicated and nasty. And yes, that's the famous case where the Rav was accused of corruption, which the Jewish judge, Cohen, I think his name is Abraham, his decision was printed in the Jewish Advocate, and the Rav was completely cleared of this. What a lot of people don't realize, it was the Orthodox rabbis, including one Orthodox rabbi in particular, who becomes a well-known Orthodox rabbi, who were responsible for a lot of these charges. When the Rav got there, he saw that there was hefkerus and chaos. And that's always the case. When Rav Yaakov Yosef came to New York, there was chaos. And the problem is, when you try to unify it, that's a good thing. But on the other hand, there's other rabbis giving hashkacha, and you're taking away their parnasa. We saw this with the Ritbaz, Yaakov Dobrovolsky in Chicago. And of course, you have to deal with the butchers and the shochtim who might not like what you're doing. So the system we have today is a lot better than they had. Nissen says that his father was the Rav of the Independent Beis Medrash. You're talking about Rabbi Greenberg, right? Is that
yes,
Rabbi Greenberg? Yes. The letter to Rabbi Greenberg was Tishrei Tavshin Chavav, so September 1965. Yes, and Greenberg's father learned in Navardic, and he learned in Navardic. The other student of the Rav who created all the controversy, David Hartman. David Hartman also didn't learn with David Hartman, where was in Lakewood. also Chabad, I think. But
Chaim Berlin, Rabbi Hartman.
Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin. Yeah. Not in Lakewood. Chaim Berlin. So you can't. I mean, people would they became very close to the Rav, but they were not Talmidim of the Rav.
Professor Shapiro. So you're yes. Underestimating the feud between and commentator between Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Greenberg, which involved certain assertions by Rabbi Greenberg about his connection to the Rav. You just passed over it, but I thought
the big issue, as I see it, was Greenberg. First of all, he basically permitted premarital sex in the interview before he altered that, and he had a contemptuous, you might say, attitude towards the halachic authorities, that they're sort of living in the dark ages and they need to modernize themselves. I don't recall, have to check, that he ever pulled authority of the Rav, that the Rav agrees with me.
Personal relationships that he claimed to have had with the Rav, which Rav Lichtenstein said he did not have.
Okay, but was that in the interview? I mean, it's I don't not gonna get into that. I mean, I remember the real issue, as I recall it, was the way he said it, and then he apologized, and he recently wrote something I don't know how many years ago, 5 years ago, in which he said it was a moment of weakness that he apologized and he should have stood up for what he said. I mean, it was ambiguous. What he said is that there needs to be a new sexual ethic. You can read the interviews. These were all reprinted, and Rabbi Greenberg wrote a memoir, as it were, discussing this. Now, there was other issues in later. The RCA actually was going to bring together, he discusses this in his second to last book, they were going to put him on trial, a tribunal, and actually expel him from the RCA because of his interfaith stuff. And then they came to their senses, I think, because they realized how this would look like an inquisition to the New York Times on a field day with this. So they didn't do that. But the 60s thing, I have to say, though, that Rav Lichtenstein went up against, not just against Rabbi Greenberg, but also against Rabbi David Hartman. And this was after Rabbi Hartman and was somewhat close to Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron even went to an event. I believe it was in Canada. Hartman had a whole big event, and Rav Lichtenstein participated in it. But he has a statement somewhere where something about the plane crashing, and that was that's Hartman, you know, that they began well, but then they crashed. Look, this was an issue, but people can tell you who were at YU in the 60s that Greenberg was very popular and he was exciting. He was speaking about matters that the students were interested in. It was the era of Vietnam, it was civil rights. Rivlin spoke about civil rights as well, but Greenberg, he was very popular, and he was exciting, and as they often are, he was exciting perhaps also because he was being controversial and saying things that no one else would say.
Professor, I just want to tell you that my father was the Rav in Providence, Rhode Island. When he came there, he had the same issue with the Rav, the Shtut Rav, Rav Werner, fought his being in Rhode Island for a long time until they came to peace. So this was not unusual that the local Orthodox rabbis on the kashrus issues.
It's an old issue. And David says, in Hilchos Malachim, the Rambam says that a non-Jew who engages in Torah is chayav misa. But the thing is, you have to clarify this, because first of all, the issue is there's a special, I was going to say it's a separate issur to teach them, but no, you're right. Now they look at it. He's not referring to, we assume the assumption is that that's by Ben Noach is allowed to. So now I have to look back at the tshuva there, why he was asked about it. It's in the Mishnah Torah. I think that's the distinction. I have to look again. I'll look for next class about, the Rambam there. The Sri Yesh uses this. It's very important because the Sri Yesh, makes a hekesh, an analogy, in the Mishnah Torah between a non-Jew, the Rambam says, can't establish his own religion. And he makes a parallel to that, studying Torah, that it's only forbidden to study Torah if you're doing it for religious purposes. So the Sri Yesh therefore says that you can teach a non-Jew Torah, a non-Jew can study Torah if it's only for intellectual purposes. Okay, quickly, I'll finish up here. 12th century Egypt had a significant Coptic Christian community. Okay, that's true. Rabbi Kelman explains why New Testament is the best and most accurate name for the New Testament. Yes. And okay, so David says that this is what I remembered, that he established the day of 9th of Marcheshvon and the 6th in honor of his ascent to Har HaBayit. Okay, now you quote his letter. The thing is that in the letter of which is quoted here by you're right, I'm sorry. He says Ushne Yamim Ela, that is the both days, including the second day, Tishi of Marcheshvan. You're right, I'm sorry that in this ninth day he did go on the ninth day he went to Hebron. And he was able to kiss the graves there. And on the fifth day, you're correct. On Yom Chamishi, on the sixth day of Cheshvan, thank you. I didn't look far enough in the letter. He went on Har HaBayit. So is this the proof that you can go on Har HaBayit? This is cited by everyone. But of course, we all know you're allowed to go on Har HaBayit. Everyone agrees that you can go on Har HaBayit. The question is, where in Har HaBayit? Everyone agrees that there are places in Har HaBayit you're allowed to go. The reason we don't go in Har HaBayit, for those of us who don't go, is because we're not sure of where that is, and therefore we avoid it. But if the Rambam was sure of where he can go, then he's allowed to go. And Ramer Soloveitchik, his podcast today, the podcast is the Tikva podcast. It's Jerusalem 365. Mentions the letter which the Rambam reports he entered the Beis Hamikdash and prayed there. Okay, thank you very much. I didn't know, so it's a shachar pratis. David says that Ella has many Arabs. For the Rav, it wouldn't matter if it was Arabs. The fact is that it's a Jewish company doing it, and you can't assume Ella was not a Shomer Shabbos airline. You have to assume that in New York, when they're getting the food together, there has to be a Jew working there. They had no reason to make it just for Arabs because it wasn't. They weren't a Shomer Shabbos company. Well, was Safra Sephardic? Am I sure about that? I'm not sure. I just assume from the name Safra. I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Okay. And I think we've spoken long enough now, and I could go on. If I missed anyone and you think it's important, send me an email. I'll get to it at the top of next class. But I see that the topic is exciting. It's interesting. Rav Soloveitchik, the fact that we have people here who knew Rav Soloveitchik, whose parents knew him, who were friends with him, maybe even some of our Mamasha Ben Bayit, we've seen, Nikki said, of Rav Soloveitchik. It's exciting to me because my relationship with him was being in the car, helping him up the steps for just that month when I was in his kollel. But that was the last time he did, that was the last summer he gave shiur. He obviously, although I had interesting conversations with him, which I've shared before, and in the 10 minutes from the Tursky's house to where we went, I don't have the personal relationship, and it's a treat for me to hear from those who have this personal relationship, which adds texture and completes the portrait. At the end of the day, I'll just say one thing, Nikki, and then you can end it for us. Rav Yechiyahu Yaakov Weinberg says, and this really applies to himself, but it applies to the Rav, great people don't take it as a compliment if you say that everything is at peace with them, and that they're, that everything is simple in them, that's not great people. Great people are constantly thinking about things and they're effervescent. So that's not a compliment to say that, everything is calm on the inside and everything is settled. No, great people are always thinking and rethinking. And we'll end, Nikki, just a final comment before Rabbi Kelman.
No, I just wanted to say he was my Masada Kedushin. So he was,
you said your family was very close. So.
Very close to him. Yes. Mrs. Soloveitchik was my role model in life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm honored that you're with us.
Thank you. If I may, very quickly, the story I heard, and if somebody knows that I'm wrong, I could be totally wrong here, say the story you said on the plane, and Rabbi Hartman, was the way I heard the stories, he went to ask the Rav if he should go to Harvard and to study philosophy, and the Rav said yes, and he was concerned, it may cause problems, and the Rav said that, people get on a plane, it occasionally crashes, and he came back to the Rav a few years later and said, the plane crashed.
That's why I've heard that story as well. Actually, it's Fordham. He didn't go to Harvard. He went to Fordham. But yes,
that's the story. Didn't go to Harvard? Well. Okay, he was rabbi in Montreal. That's what you refer to Canada. He was rabbi at TBDJ at the Bailey Shul in Montreal, which is the leading Orthodox shul where Chaim Steinmetz was the rabbi for 25 years before he came out to KJ. That's where Rabbi Hartman was. And from there, of course, he made Aliyah. I was a little kid then, but thank you very much. We look forward to next week, and thank you everybody for being here. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, continue his series and say for the